This is Growing in Grace, the sermon podcast of Rock Chapel, located in Granite Falls, North Carolina. Every week, Pastor Casey Fenn takes us on a journey through the pages of the Bible, pointing out the ancient wisdom, practical insights, and transformative power of God revealed through the gospel of Jesus Christ. Join us today as we explore God's Word and learn how we can better love God, love others, and grow in grace.
If you have a Bible and you would like to follow along this morning, you are welcome to turn to Ephesians chapter 5, Ephesians chapter 5, and we are going to read verses 21 through 6:4. This is part of Paul's letter to the church at Ephesus, where he is dealing in particular with families and what Christian families should look like. This is sort of the ideal that he puts up for husbands and wives, for parents and for children. So Ephesians chapter 5, starting with verse 21, then going down through chapter 6, verse 4. Here's what Paul writes. He says, "And be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Back when I was in youth, I was a junior senior in high school, and in my youth group at the church where I was at in Atlanta, they decided to try something new. They decided to try a youth leadership team. And so they were going to bring on, I don't know, four or five youth that were going to help plan things for the church youth group. And so they were going to plan our summer camp and going to plan different events that we had throughout the year and maybe be involved in some other leadership capacities. And when I heard about this, I really, really wanted that. I mean, I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be able to have a say. I wanted to be able to, you know, feel like I had some authority, some control, some say in the direction that we were going. There's something about authority. There's something about being able to be in control. That when there's a question of who gets to decide anything, whether it's where you're going out to eat or where you're going to church or where you're going to live or anything else, when there's a question about who gets to make the decision, there is a sense in which all of us have this urge to get that authority, to be able to be the one in charge, to be the one who gets to say, you know, what is and what isn't, who gets to set the course for things. There's a sense in which I think most people have this urge to get, to grab on to something like that. I know that I did, and I can still vividly remember when I was not chosen, and instead all of the youth leaders, her favorite youth, me and the youth leader did not get along. We didn't see eye to eye on some things. And all of her favorite people were on that, and I can just remember being kind of bitter towards her because of that. Because they did it the year that I was a senior, so that was my last year, and she had like these ninth graders on it. And it always just kind of got under my skin because I wanted to get that. And instead of getting that authority, that position, that ability to speak into things, I didn't. I found that just in general, as human beings, if there is authority to be had, we all want it. We all want it. We all want to get and hold on to that power, to that authority. We see it illustrated in a million different ways around the world. We can see it on the international stage. We see it right now in Ukraine and in Israel. International, you know, events taking place, and what's it over? Who gets to have authority over this piece of land? We also see it, though, in our own relationships. We see it in our marriages. We see it in our relationships with our children. Who gets to have the say of where we go and what we do? If there is authority, we all want it. This was no different than, you know, for Jesus, his disciples, and it is for us today or around the world. There's a story that Mark tells in chapter 9 of his gospel where Jesus and the disciples, they've been together for a number of years, and they're sort of making their way, and I kind of get the feeling that the disciples have separated themselves a little bit, and they're discussing and arguing, and Jesus overhears them, and he goes over to them and tries to, you know, find out what they're talking about, and he discovers that they are arguing about who's the greatest. Which one of the disciples is the best? And I'm sure they all had their reasons for why they were the best. You know, one of them might say, well, I was the first person to recognize that Jesus was the Messiah. And another says, well, I was the first person that Jesus chose. And another one says, well, I'm always the one Jesus answers, or I'm the one that Jesus is always spending more time around. So they're sort of arguing about who is the greatest. And Jesus overhears this, and he goes over to them, and he confronts them, and he leaves them with this, that whoever wants to be the greatest must become the last and the servant of all. And Jesus didn't just teach that. He didn't just say, listen, greatness is not found in getting authority. Instead, greatness is found in giving what we have. Jesus doesn't just teach this with his words. It's not just a nice Sunday school lesson. It is a way of life that Jesus exemplified on a day-to-day basis. We see it in his entire ministry as he served the least of these, as he knelt down at the feet of the poor and the sick and the woman caught in adultery. We see it in John 13 when Jesus kneels down at his disciples' feet and he washes them doing the work of a servant. We see it throughout Jesus' entire ministry. And based on the passage we read at the beginning of the service this morning, Philippians 2, Paul says we see it most clearly in what we call the incarnation, when God the Son put on flesh and dwelt among us. That Paul writes that Jesus, God the Son, didn't regard equality with God a thing to be held on to, but emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. Rather than hold on and grab to authority, the authority and the power that he had, rather than get and focus on get, Jesus gave up his power. He gave up his prerogative. He gave up his authority for the sake of his people. And in fact, if you go back and you read Philippians 2, we didn't read this verse, but about a verse or two before verse 5, it's verse 3 or 4, Paul tells the Philippian church, he says, consider yourselves, or consider others rather, more important than yourselves. And then he goes on and he describes how Jesus didn't grab authority, but instead freely gave it up for the sake of his people. And what Paul says is we ought to live the same way. A life of freely giving what we deserve. Of being willing to give rather than focus so much on get. This is the lesson that Paul is driving home here in the book of Ephesians. We talked about Ephesians some over the past few weeks, and if you're aware or kind of familiar with the book, then you may know that the book of Ephesians is all about bringing this church together that's kind of divided. And the way that Paul encourages them to do that is to give up what they might rightfully claim and instead give it. And so if you read chapter 5, you'll find that he encourages them here at the end to be filled with the Spirit, and then he lists some things that will happen as they are filled with the Spirit. And the last thing he lists is verse 21, the first verse we read, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Now, keep in mind, he is not, in verse 21, speaking to, you know, families. In verse 21, he's speaking to the whole church. He's like speaking up to all of us. And Paul says to all of us, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Paul is introducing an idea, a principle that really is at the foundation of all Christian relationships, of all godly relationships. And it's this, that godly relationships are rooted in mutual submission. Mutual submission. That's what Paul lays out in verse 21. Be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. That there is a sense in which every one of us are called to submit ourselves or to submit something about ourselves for the sake of everyone else. It's sort of like what we talked about last week. If we're really going to have a healthy relationship, I have to make room for you. And so there are things that I have to submit or lay down in order to make room for not only you, but what you need. And that's how we live at peace, is both of us are willing to submit certain things, to compromise certain things, so that we can both have what we need, even though we might not get everything that we want. See, godly relationships are rooted in mutual submission. Now, someone might say, well, if Kelly's here, right, and he wants this thing, and I'm over here, and I want that thing, and we do what Kelly wants, then really Kelly's the one who's in charge, right? Because I just submitted to him. So how can a mutual submission work? What does that look like? Does it even make sense? And the answer is yes. Paul lays it out here in these verses that we read, because the things that we are submitting are different. See, there's a mutual submission that's taking place. Both of us are laying something down, but the things that we're laying down are different. And so Paul begins to explore what this mutual submission looks like, what godly relations look like within the context of a family, of a father and a mother and children. And he begins to explore this mutual submissive relationship in order for us to understand how all godly relationships look, what mutual submission might look like in other contexts. See, what mutual submission does is it moves us from a get posture where I'm worried about what I want, what I'm going to have, and it moves us instead into a give posture where I'm more concerned with what I'm supposed to be giving and what my responsibility is. I'm not focused on the privilege, I'm focused on the responsibility. I'm not focused on getting, I'm focused on giving. Now, one of the other things that I think is worth noting, and one of the reasons maybe why Paul goes into the family, is because within the church, we should be submitting to one another, he says in verse 21. But let me tell you something, you get a lot more practice of submitting to one another at home than you do in the church. And so if you want to get really good at learning this mutual submission thing, start in your home, and then it can work its way out into the church and in all of your other relationships. Your home is the kind of a laboratory of love and holiness. It's a place where God can sanctify you and change you. So we have this kind of understanding that mutual submission is sort of at the foundation of all godly relationships. But then Paul begins to explore what this looks like in this family context. And I'm going to skip verses 22 through 24. And I'm going to instead start with verse 25. We're going to start with husbands, and the reason we're starting with husbands is because Paul says more to husbands than he says to wives. So we're going to start with husbands, and then we're going to look at wives, and then we're going to look at children, and then at fathers. We're sort of going in order of how much time he spends on each one rather than the order in which he wrote it. And we're also starting with husbands because not only does Paul spend more time with husbands, but according to Paul, husbands should be the initiator. That really the way the family functions, much of it depends on the husband fulfilling what he's been called to do. And that then it sort of filters down into everything else. So it makes sense for us to start there. Look at what Paul writes in verse 25. He says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself." Let me, before we go any further, let me just take a moment and step out and say this. We live in a sinful world. And there are a lot of people who are sinful, to put it simply. And because of that, what Paul is laying out here is the ideal Christian family. Now, we all know that not every family today is ideal, that there are all kinds of situations. There are situations where husbands have been abusive. There are situations where wives have been abusive. There are situations where people have been unfaithful. All of those things happen. And Paul knows that. And in fact, Paul addresses some of those issues in 1 Corinthians 7. Jesus addresses those in the Gospels. And we could talk about those. But right now, what we want is the ideal. Because once we see the ideal, it's a lot easier to see what's going wrong in all of the others. Does that make sense? So if we say something or we talk about something this morning and you think, well, that's not my experience, I understand. And we could talk about those individual cases. But what we need before we talk about the individual cases is the ideal. Then we can go into those individual cases. I think it's important for us to recognize that and understand that. And for those who maybe have been in situations that have been less than ideal, to realize that they're, you know, your past does not define your future. And that God is able to redeem every situation, and he is able to work in the midst of every situation, and he is able to redeem from every sin. That's important for us to recognize. So with all that said, let's reflect for a moment on how Paul describes the husband and again, what the husband gives. What the husband gives. Here's the way I would summarize all of sort of Paul's discussion here in verses 25 through 29. Husbands are to lovingly submit their personal desires to the good of their wives. Let me say that again. Husbands are to lovingly submit their personal desires to the good of their wives. Now, someone might say, well, Paul doesn't tell the husband to submit to the wife. But in a sense, he does tell the husband to submit his desires to the good of his wife. Read it again. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. Remember what we said in Philippians 2, that Paul writes that Christ, because of the love that he had for his people, that he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant and became obedient even to death on a cross. In other words, Christ submits his own desires and his own authority and power for the good of his people, the church. And so Christ is willing to go places that just at a personal level, he probably would have preferred not to go for the sake of the church. He submits his will and his desires for the sake of his people. We see this really, really clearly in the Garden of Gethsemane. Just hours before Jesus is arrested and crucified, he's there in the garden crying out before God. And if you'll remember, he says, "Father, if there is any other way, let this cup pass from me." In other words, "Father, this is not what my flesh, what my humanity wants to do. Yet, not my will, but thine be done." And so Christ submits to the will of the Father for the sake of his bride, the church. And this is the picture that Paul gives us of what a husband ought to be. That a husband ought, towards his wife, prioritize showing holy love. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we talked about holy love is that love that acts, that love that moves, that love that's not just a feeling but an action. And it is not just an action, but it's a kind of sacrificial action. It's a willingness to put down my own desires and preferences and power for the sake of the one that I love. And it is a love that endures to the end. It doesn't give up because maybe things get frustrating or hard, but continues and perseveres. And so Paul says, listen, the husband, the Christian husband, ought to reflect the love of Jesus towards his people. Now, man, we could explore that and talk about that in so many different ways, but I think one of the things we need to think about is as husbands, we have been called to love our wives in sacrificial ways. We have been called to be willing to put down our own desires and preferences for the good of our wives. Now, notice what I said. For the good of our wives. I didn't just say that husbands ought to just do whatever their wives say, because there may be things that wives want that is not for their good or anybody else's good. If the wife comes to the husband and says, "Look, I know that we're $50,000 in debt, but could we just get one more credit card? I just got a couple more things that I need to buy." It would not be for the good of the wife or anybody else for him to say, "Yes, ma'am, whatever you say." See, it's not just that the husband goes along with whatever the wife wants or whatever the wife says, but it's that the husband is always looking out for the good of the wife, for the spiritual good of the wife. That he's looking, just as Christ did toward the church, he's looking for ways that he can help her grow in holiness and blamelessness, that she can become more of what God desires her to be. That is the husband's number one priority. It's important for us as Christian husbands to recognize that, that holy love is our priority. The other thing it's important to recognize is that Jesus initiated the relationship with his people. Jesus is the one who came while we were yet sinners. And in the same way, I believe Paul is encouraging husbands to be the initiator of the relationship. To be the initiator of things. That I, as a husband, do not have the sort of prerogative to sort of sit back and say, "Well, my wife doesn't do any of the things that I want to do. Meanwhile, I'm not doing anything to love her in a sacrificial way." I've got no right to do that. If I am a Christian husband, it's my responsibility to initiate by loving her the way Christ loved the church. If she doesn't see the love that I have for her, I shouldn't expect her to want to do anything. See, we as Christian husbands have been called to take the initiative and to love her the way Christ loves his people. When that happens, Christian husbands become a reflection of Jesus. When people look at them, they see that's what Jesus' love for the church is like. And there are people probably that you've met in your life, husbands, who have had that kind of Christian love for their wife. And where when you look at it, you don't just see, you know, a man's love for a woman, but you see the love of God in that person. There are multiple people I can think of who fit that bill that I've had the privilege of getting to know. And I've seen men who are strong men, and yet who are willing to sacrifice for their wives in great ways because of the deep love that they have for them. Willing to not ever take, you know, almost anything for themselves, but instead are always focused on what their spouse needs. That is the love of Christ manifest in the love of a husband. That's the first thing that Paul really addresses. That's the thing he wants to drive home, and that's what he spends most of the time here dealing with. And I think that part of the reason why is because it's so easy for husbands to have a get rather than a give attitude and to sort of latch on to the authority. Well, I'm the head of the house. Well, I make the money. Well, I do this. No. We don't have a get attitude. We have a give attitude. How am I serving? Not how can I grab on to authority and use it to manipulate and get my way. So husbands lovingly submit their personal desires to the good of their wives. Wives, on the other hand, respectfully submit their independence to the leadership of their husbands. Look at Ephesians 5, verses 22 through 24, and then we'll jump down to 33. He says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything." And then verse 33, "Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband." A couple of things about this that are important to note. The first one is the instructions to the wife are rooted in verse 21, where Paul says, "Submit yourselves to one another." If you have a translation like the NASB, which I'm using, you'll see that in verse 22, the words "be subject" are in italics. Now, anytime you see italics in the Bible, what that means is the word is not actually in Greek. So they're having to supply that so that they can make the translation make sense, because it doesn't actually say, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." It actually just says, "Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord." So the question then is, how do we know it means be subject? Well, the reason we know is because of verse 21. See, Paul says, "and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ." He's talking to the whole church. And then in verse 22, he gets more specific, and he says, "Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord." In other words, Paul's command to the wives is a command that's rooted in his command to everyone to be subject to one another, to have this mutual submission. And so Paul is saying that in a sort of unique and particular way, wives ought to be subject to their own husbands as to the Lord. Again, it's important to recognize it doesn't just say be subject to men, but to your own husbands as to the Lord. Now, one of the things that can kind of trip us up here is we look at verse 33, and it says that each of you is to love his own wife even as he loves himself, or even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. In Greek, the word for respect is literally the word fear. And when we hear that, it's actually the same word we find in verse 21, where he says, "and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ." And then in verse 33, he says, "and the wife must see to it that she fears her husband." Same word. Now, we hear that, and we sort of, prickle a little bit, like, what? Because we have this idea, very much, I think, especially in our society, when we hear the word fear, we immediately think of terror. We think of a horror movie. Nobody wants a marriage like a horror movie, right? Some of you may have been in marriages like horror movies before. We don't want that. And so we hear the word fear, and we think, man, that sounds really unhealthy and really bad, and that's not anything that I want. Let me give you kind of a different way of thinking about this word fear and respect and what it means. I think respect is probably a better way to understand it. It's closer. When this word is used in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, we see places in the Old Testament where it talks about fearing God, right, and keeping his commandments. There are places in the New Testament where it talks about God-fearers. What's going on there? What is this emotion? Is it terror? No. Fear is the natural result when I understand two things. When I encounter someone or something, and I realize, first of all, my vulnerability, that in this relationship, I am the more vulnerable participant. See, when someone approaches God and God reveals himself, the reason that they fear is because, first of all, they recognize they are vulnerable in light of who God is. And so they recognize their vulnerability, and then the second thing they realize and they see is the power or the authority or the strength of the person that they're with. And so these two things happen. I'm vulnerable. This person is powerful. And fear is the natural result, because we understand that if that power is used in a dangerous way, that I'm vulnerable to being in this situation. You might think of it in the same way that growing up, my family was around guns, and I remember getting my first BB gun, and my dad, I can still to this day, every time I'm around a gun or handle one, I can hear his voice in my head. There's two things that I can hear him telling me, and one of them is, son, you don't ever point a gun at anybody, you know, obviously unless they're coming at you, but you don't ever point a gun at anybody. That's the first thing that I can hear my dad saying because he said it. The second thing is that you always treat a gun as if it's loaded, even if you just unloaded it. Even if you know it doesn't have anything in it, you treat it as if it is. Why? Because it may be. And you may have just not realized that something could have happened, or maybe you'll be in a situation where you forgot to and you think you did. You always treat it as if it's loaded. Now, I'm not terrified of guns. You know, I know some people who, if they're in the same room as a gun, you know, they'll scream and run out of the room. I have a healthy fear of guns because I know of what they're capable of doing. I know that if it's me versus a gun, I'm vulnerable and it's powerful. And because of that, there's a fear that's there. There's a respect and a reverence that's there simply because I recognize my vulnerability and its power. And I know that if that the power of that thing is used in a towards me, then I'm vulnerable to it. This is the idea, I think, that Paul is getting at here, that wives, especially in Paul's day, but even today, I, as much as our society wants to just eliminate the line between men and women, the reality is that women are, on average, more vulnerable than their partners. Their partners have a power and a strength and an authority that the woman does not have, that the wife does not have. And because of that, the wife is vulnerable in a lot of different ways. Physically, the wife, on average, is vulnerable. Economically, the wife, on average, has traditionally been vulnerable. In a lot of other ways, the wife has been vulnerable. And because of that, there is this sense that when you enter into this relationship, you understand that there's this difference in power, that I'm vulnerable in light of your strength. And because of that, you need to recognize that fact. You need to understand that that's just a reality, and that's what Paul is encouraging them to do. But here's the thing about it. Now, this is the part that I think is really kind of cool, because when we first hear this, we recoil. But let's be honest. If I come into a relationship with someone, and I'm the vulnerable partner, I'm the vulnerable person, and they're the ones who have the strength and the power, greater strength than I do, and then I see that they are using that strength not for their own good, but for my good. That makes it really, really easy to follow. When I understand that they are using their strength not against me, not to manipulate me, not to use me, but they are using that strength for my benefit. They're using that strength to protect me. They're using that strength to give life, to encourage, to be there, to support. Man, it makes it really easy to follow. And that's the picture that Paul is painting here of someone who understands, a wife who understands her own vulnerabilities, who understands her husband's power and strength, and who also has a husband who is using that strength for her good. And when that happens, there is this reciprocal relationship that begins to grow and flourish and blossom, where the wife knows that the husband is seeking her good, and then the husband knows that the wife is seeking his good, and they are able to support one another and to grow together rather than always be at each other's throats. Why? Because both of them are trying to do their own thing and want their own way and get authority rather than give what they have. See, this is the vision that Paul has. It's also worth noting, and again, this is just another thing. This is a difficult passage to preach in the time we have because there's so much here. But another thing that I would encourage you to recognize is Paul says, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. This is not a blanket statement of do whatever your husband says. Because just as wives can have bad ideas, so can husbands. This is a call to follow your husband as he follows Christ, right? Not just in any direction that there is. And so the way that we think about this, the way I would encourage you to think about this is as almost a dance, right? If you've got a dance, especially a traditional dance, maybe not so much today, but in traditional dances where you would have two partners, you would have a lead and you would have a follow, and the lead determined the direction and maybe the pace and which moves were next. And it was the follow's, you know, responsibility to read the lead and follow the lead. And this is the picture that we have that Paul sort of paints in between husbands and wives, a lead and a follow. And the hope is that if the lead has the follow's best interest in mind, that both of them create something beautiful rather than creating the disasters that we so often see in our world. That's the picture Paul paints. Look now at our sort of next relationship, that children are to obediently submit their words and actions to their parents. This is what Paul lays out in chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, where he says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth." That children are to obediently submit their words and actions to their parents. Again, just as with the wife, this is not a blanket, children, you must do whatever your parents say. He says, obey your parents in the Lord. If a parent tells a child to do something wrong, that child is not held to the responsibility to do that thing. They are to obey their parents in the Lord. There are limits to the obedience of a children. And what those children should or shouldn't do. A couple of things that I want to touch on here. One is this. We live in a society where we've tried to blur lines, not just between husbands and wives, but between parents and children. We don't like lines. Everyone is just a individual, right? And we want to all think of ourselves as just individuals and all of those, you know, everything else we need to just eliminate. And so because of that, as parents, many of us have been fooled into thinking that we must either become, for some people, the rival of our children or the buddy of our children. And that sort of becomes the picture that gets painted there, that we are rivals with them or just their buddies. And this creates homes that are chaotic. And it creates genuine problems. Children need to learn submission at home. If they don't learn to submit to the authority of their parents, they will never learn to submit to any authority. Part of the reason that we have so much conflict within our world today is because we have children who have never learned to submit in even the smallest ways, and because of that, they think they always have to have their own way. There's been a tremendous impact over the past 50 years of parents, and in particular fathers, who have not been in homes demanding submission of their children. And because of that, children are not better off. You can look statistically at the results of that, and the results have been children who have, you know, more educational problems, who have a harder time at school, who have a harder time, you know, getting work, who have all kinds of problems. And it's rooted in parents who are not calling their children to obedience and training their children in how to submit at home so that then they can learn to submit it elsewhere. Children need to obediently submit their words and actions to their parents, again, in the limits of in the Lord. The final thing is verse 4, where Paul writes and says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord." Here's what the way I would kind of summarize this, that parents lovingly submit their parenting to the future good of their children. In other words, that as parents, my goal is not to create a best friend. That as a parent, my goal is to raise up a child in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. My children are a charge to keep. And you know, we talk about this at the beginning of the year when we do baby dedications. One of the things that we talk about is how the best way to ensure, or to at least get close to ensuring your children remain believers into their 30s and 40s, is by having spiritual conversations with them throughout the week. It is your responsibility as parents to train your children up in the fear and the discipline and the instruction of the Lord. It is your responsibility. The church serves a role. That's why every Sunday I pray and ask that God would help the church equip parents to do that. But ultimately, if you are not seeing that as a responsibility yourself, then it's not going to get done the way that it ought to get done. And you are shirking a responsibility that God has given you as a parent, as a father, as a mother. It's also worth recognizing that he says, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger. I know it's easy for some of us as fathers to sort of think, well, that's my wife's responsibility. No, it's not. It's your responsibility. Fathers, it is your responsibility to lead in the training and instruction of your children. You may feel totally unequipped to do that. I understand. That's part of the goal and the purpose of the church, to help you. That's my desire, is that we would have fathers who would be equipped to do that, have husbands and wives both who are equipped to do that. But you as fathers need to see that as your responsibility, and you need to take on that responsibility. The goal is all building one another up in the faith. So we might ask ourselves the question, how can we cultivate this kind of mutual submission? And I think we can cultivate mutual submission by meditating on Christ's willful submission, that submission we see in Philippians chapter 2, and praying for God to work that same attitude out in our lives and our relationships. In fact, I would encourage you to read through Philippians 2, the whole chapter, a couple of times, and it will help. It will sort of let that be your meditation. Those verses are very powerful. In fact, right now, as we prepare to close, we're going to receive communion. And, you know, one of the wonderful things that communion does is it gives us a visible picture of the gospel, because in the gospel, we come to Christ without any money, without earning anything. We come with empty hands, simply receiving what Christ has given us, his life, his blood, his body. And we see in the communion elements, in that bread, we see the body of Christ, and we are reminded that Christ gave his life. He humbled himself and submitted himself and gave his life for our good. And when we drink that juice, we are reminded that he shed his blood for our sake, so that we would be forgiven and redeemed. And this morning, as we come, as we eat and as we drink, one of the things that we ought to do, that I would encourage you to do, is to reflect on your own relationships within your family. And how is Christ's love being reflected in those relationships? How are you as a husband showing the love of Christ to your wife? And wives, how are you as a wife showing the submission of the church towards your husband? How are you as a parent seeking to parent your child in a way that helps them grow in the faith rather than cuts them down or destroys them? How are you as a child being obedient and honoring your father and your mother? And I would encourage you to reflect on those things, to examine your heart before you come, and then to come and to eat and to drink and to remind yourself, not just with your mind, but with your whole body, remind yourself of Christ's death and resurrection and what it means for us and how it can be reflected in each one of our lives. Here's what I'm going to encourage you to do, maybe something a little bit different than normal. Since we're talking about the family and we're thinking about the family, that if you have family here this morning, I would encourage you to take communion together as a family, to eat and drink together, maybe spend a moment praying together. And if you see someone who maybe doesn't have any family here,
why don't you adopt them for a few minutes? Grab them and bring them over and you pray with them. But let's be reminded. Be reminded not only of what Christ has done, but how Christ desires for his love and his glory and his character to be reflected in us. Would you pray with me?
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Growing in Grace. We hope that you've been encouraged and challenged to love God, love others, and grow in grace. If you'd like to learn more about our congregation, you can visit our website at rockchapel.org. And if you have questions or need prayer, you can contact us at rockchapelmail@gmail.com. Again, thanks for listening, and we look forward to welcoming you back next week as we continue to explore God's Word together.